I'm gonna kick off my shoes because I'm wearing my squeakiest shoes.
My toes are hot.
Thank you, Max McKenna. Maybe in a week or 2 weeks or something, you can bring me on to the Pretty Dead Boys.
Drink a LaCroix or something.
Welcome to the Pre-Dead Boys. It's a podcast about the history and culture of death and decomposition. My name is Dorian. With me, as always, is Max. It is the spooky season.
It is.
It's well underway.
Uh-huh.
How's your spooky season going? Have you been doing spooky things?
I hung out in some caverns.
Oh?
I hung out in some caverns 2 days ago.
Okay.
It was very cool. I learned the difference between caves and caverns.
What is the difference?
A cave has natural light. A cavern has no natural light, so we did the thing where they turn the lights off.
Yeah.
And it's just pitch black. You can't see anything.
So is a cavern just a cave that goes deep enough?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like, it's more like a corridor, I think.
Okay.
So, I don't know. That's what the guy said. It was really cool down there,
mm-hmm.
So I was looking around at stuff and not really paying attention.
Was that Olentangy Indian Caverns? Or
no, to Ohio Caverns.
Oh.
Just like in Bell Fountain.
Okay. That's tight.
Yeah. It was rad. A lot of cool crystal formations.
Right on.
Neat stuff.
I have not been doing anything involving nature or anything, but I did watch a lot of scary movies the past few weeks, and I'm still geeking over how good Nightmare on Elm Street 3 was.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you were very high on that.
Yeah. It's very good. It's very corny.
How's the skull coming along?
Ooh, I still got to work on that. So...
Okay.
I think I told you the bones that fuse together to form the skull
sure.
are starting to crack apart. So I need to...
Oh.
I'm still kind of looking into what adhesive would work best to lock that all in.
Sure.
I've read some stuff about bone gluing on the internet, and people recommend Elmer's glue because you can... If you mess it up, you can undo that.
Yeah.
Bones that used to be fused together, it's... Kind of easy to tell where they're supposed to
yeah.
go. But I don't want to use an adhesive that expands, because that'll ruin it.
You learned all this from Jacob's Bones?
I did.
That little kid?
I did. If you are listening and you don't know about Jacob's Bones, basically this 10-year-old kid in England has a blog where he explains to you how to care for and maintain bones.
Yeah,
and
it rules. Them.
And he breaks it down for each stage. Like, how much do you do if the flesh is just starting to decompose?
You gotta get beetles.
How much do you do if there's no flesh left and it's pretty clean bone? You gotta do something to clean it. He's got so many stages in between. And this kid has already accomplished at least 3 times as much as I will in my lifetime. And he's just getting started.
Yeah, so, he's super goth.
Yes, shout out to Jacob's Bones. And thanks for the bone tips.
I'll tweet at him.
Is he on Twitter?
I don't know. He's 10. He can't sign up for an account.
Legally, not yet.
Yeah.
Well, we're not here to talk about bones. Well, we might talk about bones.
No.
But that's the thing. I don't know what we're going to talk about. All I know is that you've prepared something about death.
I have.
What do you have for us this week?
So, Dorian, before we start, I did want to make note of this. Where we are at right now in the year, baseball season is about to wrap up.
Okay. I'm so sorry for your loss.
I'm bummed about that. But I think about things in terms of the length of a baseball season, because about this time of year, baseball season is insufferably long.
Yeah.
Like, I'm amped on baseball from April until mid-June, and then it just feels insufferable. And we've been doing this podcast for over a baseball season at this point.
Wow.
And I'm super stoked about it.
Yeah.
It makes me really happy, you know? Like, for being a thing going on for an interminable length of time. Which is baseball. I'm glad that we've been able to do this for this long.
Let me tell you, I've certainly been having more fun than I would watching baseball. But that's just me.
I'm having more fun doing this than I would be if I was at the Owl City show that's happening right now.
Oh, yeah. I'm really sorry that you're missing out on 1,000 hugs from 10,000 lightning bugs.
You know, that song was popular in 2009. Do you know what else was popular in 2009?
No, what?
Twilight.
Okay.
Do you know what Twilight has in it?
Are we about to talk about vampires?
Yeah.
Yes!
You like that, you call me George W. Bush, because I did a great job with that segue. Fuck. I don't know. Oh, boy. Yeah, we're going to be talking about vampires today. So without further ado, let's crack into the topic with the Pre-Dead Boys cracking into the topic with a fresh, cool, all-natural LaCroix moment.
It's legally all-natural.
Legally.
They've settled that.
Blood is all natural. So, I think vampires is a common enough thing that this is an instance where we're all on the same page. Just to be clear, let's define our terms and get a baseline definition for what a modern vampire is.
A vampire is a being from folklore that subsists by feeding on the vital force, generally in the form of blood, of the living. Vampiric entities have been recorded in most cultures. The term vampire was popularized in Western Europe after reports of an 18th century mass hysteria of a pre-existing folk belief in the Balkans and Eastern Europe that in some cases resulted in corpses being staked and people being accused of vampirism. Vampirism? Vampirism.
Vampirism.
Vampirism. Local variants in Eastern Europe were also known by different names, such as Striga in Albania, Vrikolakos in Greece, and Strigor in Romania. Throwing some curveballs my way in those notes, man.
I had to work for some of these pronunciation keys. So as you can see, vampires are one of the most widespread monsters. They're all over Europe, and as we're going to see later, they're actually all over the world as well. I know we didn't mention it in that definition, but there are instances of vampire legends from every inhabited continent on the world. That doesn't count Antarctica, even though 30 Days of Night is a movie, which we can talk about later.
Wasn't that Alaska?
Was it Alaska?
I think so.
I don't know. It's cold. It's snowy.
You know, it's funny. In our Thing bonus episode, I think that I made the mistake of switching Antarctica and Alaska. So we've got a reputation now of just being inconsiderate podcast hosts that...
of not knowing which part is the cold part of the world.
They're just like, it's all cold. It's all the cold. Same. We don't give a shit.
Sorry to all our Alaskan listeners.
Cold nation bigots.
So we'll get cold. We'll go on a worldwide tour of different vampires later in the episode. So don't worry. But you remember how when we did zombies, we learned that zombies have remained remarkably consistent across a lot of time and pretty much every culture that they show up in.
Yeah.
Well, that's not really the case with vampires. So, Dorian, when you think of a vampire, when you do like your little mental drawing of a vampire,
yeah,
what do you think of? What does it look like?
Okay, I'm getting in the mental space now.
Yeah.
I'm drawing a picture.
Paint us this picture. What does it look like?
Not sparkly.
Not sparkly. So you go with the tough vampire.
Yeah. Yeah, I think... you know, they probably got fangs, but maybe they're retractable fangs, depending on the situation. They're real cool. Maybe wearing a lot of black, looking awesome. Maybe pale.
Okay.
Stylish.
Sure.
And not around during the day.
Uh-huh.
And they can look like Bill Paxton in Near Dark, where he's got sunglasses and blood all over his face.
Yeah. So you're describing almost like the Lost Boys vampire.
Yeah, that's
kind of... Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah, that's kind of the working definition I have. Those are the movies I watched growing up that creeped me out and gave me legitimately recurring nightmares about vampires for almost my entire life.
Oh, boy. Wow, I'm really proud of you for facing your fears with this, then.
I'm not... legitimately afraid of vampires in the sense it's an irrational fear. I don't think that there are vampires and that they're coming to get me.
Sure.
But just growing up, I would repeatedly have a dream where a vampire was chasing me and it was faster than me because it had superhuman speed.
Sure.
And right when it caught up to me and was biting me was when I would wake up with a jolt. And that happened from being a little kid to into my 20s.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, it's a long one. So, the vampire you're describing sounds a lot like the modern version of the vampire.
Okay.
Where it's very pale, but like you said, like, this is a thing that comes up in vampire definitions, but almost like sexy. Vampires are very sexualized.
Yeah.
You know, like, they look good.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see how we've gone from the Nosferatu, really creepy vampire, mm-hmm. like the gross long fingers.
Yeah.
To the vampire we have now that has this almost powerful draw. We'll talk about that later. But the vampire that you're describing, that's actually almost the exact opposite of what the original description of a vampire was. So here's a description of an early vampire that I came across.
A vampire's body remains in a lifelike state with new growth of the fingernails or hair. When they feast on the blood of the living, their stomachs and bodies swell up like a drum, inflating to near a bursting point. The blood cakes to their lips and mouth, matching their dark, ruddy complexion.
Yeah, so pretty gross. It's
grimy.
Compared to what we think of vampires today, you know? Where, like, it's suave and clean, mm-hmm. you know? But these vampires are described as ruddy, which is not typically a word that we see today, but it means, like, dark red, almost. In direct contrast to how we think of vampires as being really pale, early vampires were thought to have a skin tone that almost seemed like you were outside in Florida all summer. You know those dudes who are, like, wrestling alligators on gator farms?
Yeah.
Like, leather skin?
Yes.
They're missing, like, 14 teeth.
Did the legend of vampires come from people being afraid of Floridians? Because that's a very relatable fear.
Yeah. These days, it's real creepy. We're alienating a lot of people today. In both cold and warm climates.
Let's get them all.
Yeah. And it's pretty gross that they also, and I quote, swell up like a drum when they eat. Like, they're just, like, sucking all 8 pints of blood out of this person's body. Like Violet Beauregard and Willy Wonka just expanding.
You know, the new Kirby game is really unsettling.
Kirby just sucks in blood.
And his belly swells like a drum.
But you can see how that's different than, like, the pale, elfish image that we have of a modern vampire.
Yeah.
Like the Robert Pattinson style. Or even, like, the gaunt, spooky version, like from Nosferatu.
Right.
So these descriptions of these red, blood-gorged vampires may seem weird, but that's just because we're going at them with the lens of what we have today. So think about how much blood has been associated with life throughout human history. Even if we go back to what the Greeks called the four humors, you know, you had phlegm, bile, blood, and
cum!
No.
Sorry.
Yellow bile. You had yellow bile, which I think is like bone marrow or like pus or something like that.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. So blood was known as sanguine.
Yeah.
That's the Greek word for it. You know, it's not super common these days. But if you go back to, like, novels from the 50s, they would describe people as having, like, a sanguine temperament. And that just meant that person was really active and super outgoing. Because, again, they were like, oh, blood is the life force. If you have more blood, you're super lively. So, therefore, it makes sense that if a creature was going to go around and steal your blood, they were going to steal your life force, they wouldn't be, like, thin and gaunt and pale. They wouldn't look like death.
They'd look red and juiced up.
Yeah, they would look juicy and healthy, you know?
Like a dang big old fruit gusher.
Yeah. And think about this. Speaking of gushers in the grossest possible way, nice. Think about this. You're living in the 1200s or fucking whatever. And you're bored on a Saturday night, so you accuse your neighbor who just died of being a vampire.
Very relatable.
You know, John Mulaney's got that bit about how old-timey people had to come up with slow activities to do. And it takes a long time to exhume a body.
Yeah.
So you go and you exhume your neighbor's body. What are you going to find in there? You're going to find a corpse that's bloated from all the bacteria growth that's mm-hmm. been happening in the gut. And what happens with that as well is blood will normally force its way out, usually through the nose or mouth.
Hence the ruddy lips.
Yeah. So you would find a corpse that you had accused of being a vampire, and the body that you would exhume would be bloated and have like a reddish tint to their face.
Hmm.
So that's how that early description of a vampire is kind of flipped in the way that we think of it now, you know? It's interesting. Yeah. So that's the primary description of the older European-style vampire. Remember, we're not even to Bram Stoker's Dracula yet. The vampire has existed in folklore for a super long time. But vampires were constrained to the culture that they came out of for a super long time as well. If a culture came up with a vampire legend, even though there were other vampire legends in other cultures, they wouldn't mix. That mixing didn't really happen until trade and travel became more accessible. To where, you know, people are going around on boats to different countries. If you think about it, like an old-timey boat, the crew of that boat was actually incredibly diverse for the standards of the time. People are shipping goods all over the world, you're going from port to port, and what you're going to do in those different ports is take on different crew members, and a crew member may have sailed in from India and gotten off at a port in Italy, but your boat just came down from Germany, and you're meeting up there to go to a port in Africa.
You're all over the place.
You're all over the place. And when you're on a boat late at night, you get bored, so you start telling stories. And if you're talking to a person that you've never met before, and they're from a completely different culture as you, and you're telling like horror stories around the campfire on the boat, I don't know if that's safe, but you're telling horror stories around that campfire, and you realize that, hey, this other person has the same story about this thing that sucks blood that my culture does. So you start talking. And that's when we start kind of being able to piece out these interesting little tidbits of the modern vampire lore that comes from cultures all over the world. So what I thought would be kind of cool would be to read a description of a couple different vampire legends from a global perspective, and we'll be able to see how modern vampire traits can be pulled out of those stories.
Interesting. In India, tales of Vaitalas, ghoul-like beings that inhabit corpses, are found in old Sanskrit folklore. The Vaitala is an undead creature who, like the bat associated with modern-day vampirism, hangs upside down on trees found in cremation grounds and cemeteries.
This is where we pull the bat motif from. A lot of the times in European vampirism, a vampire was just someone who would come back from the dead. They couldn't transform into anything, but they would get out of their grave and then they would go attack a townsperson or something like that. So India is actually where we get kind of the transformative nature of the vampire from.
Hmm. A Changshi, also known as a hopping vampire, is a type of reanimated corpse in Chinese legends and folklore. It is typically depicted as a stiff corpse dressed in official garments, and it moves around by hopping, with its arms outstretched. It kills living creatures to absorb their chi, or life force, usually at night. In the day, it rests in a coffin or hides in dark places, such as caves. Changshis are said to be terrified of their own reflections.
So you know what these things actually look a lot like?
What's that?
The bad guy in Big Trouble in Little China.
Ooh, yeah, okay.
Like, that's what the stylized robes are. So even if you look up modern Chinese legends of the Changshi, they look
like Lo Pan.
Yeah, like Lo Pan.
All right.
Yeah, it's very cool. And so you'll notice here, this is also where we get the modern belief that vampires don't have a reflection in mirrors.
Yeah.
But the weird thing about these, I don't know where they came up with the transportation method here, but the thought was that the body would hit rigor mortis, and then they wouldn't be able to bend their knees or arms. So they would just have to kind of spring around, like vertically.
They're human pogo sticks.
Yeah.
In the mythology of ancient Rome, the Strix was a human that had permanently turned into a bird or bat who fed on infant flesh and blood. The Strix is mentioned by Roman nobleman Titinius, who noted the placement of a head of garlic on the infant was the prescribed amulet to ward against the attack.
Yeah, so Strix are really creepy.
Yeah, sounds like
if you look up old photos of them. Not photos, but old paintings.
Sure.
Yeah, they also have that kind of transformative nature, but a lot of their transformation was done in the form of an owl, actually. And there's some debate over if the translation of the term that was used for them has more of a connotation of an owl or a bat. So that one's kind of up in the air a little bit. But this is where we get the belief that vampires don't like garlic.
I see.
You gotta put that on your baby so the vampire doesn't want to go eat your baby with bad breath.
Yeah, but that wouldn't stop me. That entices me to eat the baby, frankly.
No.
Yeah, a little bit of garlic.
Season it?
Yeah. Everything tastes better with garlic. Name one food that doesn't taste good with a little bit of garlic in it.
See, well, that I can't do, but a baby probably would taste a little better.
I'm not saying I want to eat a baby.
It more palatable.
Yeah. I would think twice if you were like, hey, Dorian, eat this baby. I'd be like, absolutely not. If you're like, hey, Dorian, eat this baby. It's got a little bit of garlic in it. I'd be like, no.
No.
Right, I'd still say no, but there'd be a split second.
You'd be like,
second,
oh, I like garlic.
A split second where I'd be curious enough to try it. Anyway, moving on. Russia had legends of the Opir, who were created when a magician or witch died and an animal or bird jumped over their grave. Although the Opir do not drink blood, they do have the ability to turn into butterflies, as Russians believe the butterfly symbolizes a departed soul. As protection against those who may turn into Opir, the living would put sawdust in the coffin, so that when the vampire awakens in the evening, they are compelled to count every grain of sawdust. This occupies the entire evening, so they will die when the sun rises at dawn. The living may also pierce the body with thorns or stakes. I like the idea that they just think butterflies are so obsessive compulsive that they're like, oh, sawdust. All right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
yeah,
7.
That's one of the weirdest parts of vampire lore is that they're super into counting. But you see it crops up occasionally. Like they'll be like, you protect your home by dumping sand or rice outside of it so that the vampire has to count all of it.
Yeah, they're all OCD apparently. This is bizarre.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know how that came about. But I do like the idea of the vampire is counting the grains of sand as the sun is rising up. He's like, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And then the sun hits him and he explodes and dies. And he's like, damn it.
It does crack me up because it's like, you know, that Sesame Street was probably privy to that when they made the count.
The count, yeah. It seems like the heaviest wink.
What parts of vampire culture can we put in this children's show? Baby eating. No, no, Carl. We can't have it eat babies. Counting. That's it.
It's the counting part.
Counting and fangs, and that's it. What does he use the fangs for? Shut up, Carl.
He opens cans with them.
And then he has to count the beans inside.
Yeah. But this is also the first instance of staking a vampire to kill it.
Yeah.
What they believed happened to the Opir when they were killed is that they would explode.
Oh.
Hence this little photo that I've dropped in your notes.
Where a dude is stabbing a skeleton with a stake and it's just shooting sparks out of its chest.
Yeah, it's really goofy.
That's very cool.
Like, a lot of these I can see having a real world parallel, and it would be like, oh yeah, this legend comes from the fact that corpses get bloated after time. I don't know what they had to do to slam a stake into this vampire and all of a sudden a bunch of sparks just started shooting out. I don't know what that was.
Is a stake made out of pure flint or something?
We've made this coffin out of tinder.
In Romanian folklore, the strigoi are live witches who will become vampires after death. They have the ability to send out their souls at night to suck the blood of family, livestock, and neighbors. Romanians would protect themselves from attacks by strigoi by lining the doorways to their homes with thorns, as a strigoi could not cross a thorned threshold.
Finally, the strigoi is where we get the idea that a vampire can't, like, enter a house of its own volition. It has to be invited in.
Yeah.
There was this thought that if you line the doorway with thorns, the vampire wouldn't want to cross it, which just leads to the invitation thing.
Yeah.
We see that in movies like Let the Right One In.
That's right.
Yeah.
That scene where she just walks in without being invited in.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's creepy, because that's not how vampires are supposed to work.
Yep.
But isn't it cool to see all these different aspects of the modern vampire legend kind of coming together from all over the world?
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I will say, though, it's pretty compelling once you find out that these are individual legends and myths.
Yeah.
They're all compelling enough that I would like to know stories just exclusively about the Strigoi and exclusively about the Upir and all of these individually. You know, it's cool that it's a melting pot of all of these things, but it would be kind of cool to dig into the individual identity of all these monsters.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really neat to see that a lot of these cultures do have their own individual stories that they told for years, and then they just had to make the vampire bigger and better and badder
yeah.
as everyone came together, you know?
Right.
So now we're going to start talking about vampires in the real world. We're moving out of folklore. So,
and into real life.
into real life. Which is going to sound crazy when I say this next sentence, which I'm going to say right now. A lot of modern folklorists theorize that diseases like tuberculosis are what typically would spark vampire crazes in the past. Tuberculosis, also known as consumption, is a really dangerous disease that usually results in a sick person wasting away and then coughing up blood until they die. What's really cool for our kind of interests and the direction of this podcast is how tuberculosis and vampire myths can combine to make it completely okay for seemingly rational people to be super cool with exhuming and just desecrating bodies. it's fascinating because that is such a taboo thing.
Yeah.
In every culture. And the second the vampire myth enters a culture, people are like, all right, let's get into this.
Right.
I found an article titled Pestilence, Riots, Lynchings, and Desecration of Corpses. The Sleep of Reason Produces Monsters by Sergio Sabatani that was published in the Italian Journal of Medical Infections. Here's actually something that he has to say on that.
Although the peak of the Enlightenment has been reached during the 18th century, we know everything in the world now. The superstition concerning the vampires increased dramatically in that period, causing a kind of insanity in European population. The panic increased when the news concerning vampire attacks spread in the Western Prussia in 1721 and in the Habsburg Empire in the period ranging from 1725 to 1734. The rural epidemics of infectious diseases, such as tuberculosis, that the people charged to the vampire attacks promoted the superstition, which has already taken place in village communities. The corpses which were suspected to be vampires were unearthed and pierced with a wooden stake. Though many scholars denied the existence of vampires and tried to divert this hysterical interest to other causes, such as premature burial or presence of rabies. It's kind of a big deal. You got to deal with that.
Yeah.
It's a little more sensible.
Yeah, I like how these scientists have been kind of the same throughout history.
Yeah.
Like, people are like, all right, we got to dig up this corpse and then smash it with a brick. It's a vampire. And the scientist is just like, no, we probably just didn't check and that person was buried alive.
Yeah.
Or they had rabies or something. I don't know.
Right.
So the tuberculosis angle actually makes a lot of sense when we consider cases of vampirism. If you were afflicted with tuberculosis, you typically wasted away extremely quickly, since your body refused to accept nutrition from food. If you're an uneducated person, you might watch your neighbor waste away, turn pale, start coughing up blood, and then you would automatically assume that they had become the victim of a vampire attack.
Absolutely.
It sounds like a textbook case. So, what you have to do then is make sure that the corpse doesn't come back. That's when people started staking corpses and doing the stuff we read about above. People have been basically desecrating corpses and burying them in compromising positions for almost for over 1,000 years. Now this article, my girlfriend actually sent me this article right before we started recording. And it's really neat. The article title is Vampire Child Discovered Buried in 5th Century Italian Cemetery. And it's pretty creepy.
The remains of a 10-year-old biting on a stone have been unearthed by archaeologists in a 5th century Italian cemetery, evidence suggesting that a vampire burial to prevent the child's return from the dead. I've never seen anything like it. It's extremely eerie and weird, said University of Arizona archaeologist David Soren, who has overseen archaeological excavations at the site since 1987. Given the age of this child and its unique deposition, with the stone placed within his or her mouth, it represents, at the moment, an anomaly within an already abnormal cemetery, said David Pickle, a doctoral student at Stanford who is the excavation director.
Here's a photo of this child.
Whoa.
Yeah.
It's biting a rock, huh?
Yeah. And this was a common thing, too. If someone had tuberculosis in life and you watched them waste away, vampires are so based in, you know, teeth, because that's how you bite into someone and drink their blood, that people would place rocks in the mouths of people that were suspected vampires to basically break their teeth and prevent their return. This vampire madness craze wasn't just constrained to Europe and old-timey people. Belief in vampires remained strong in America even up until the late 1800s. Here's an ad from a Boston magazine that was published in 1892.
Believe in vampires, Rhode Islanders who are sure that they do exist. Instances told of where the living have been attacked and preyed upon by these representatives of an unseen world. A member of the Anti-Vampire Party.
Yeah, but this was a legitimate ad in a Boston newspaper, you know, like a large city newspaper.
Yep.
Where people are certain that there's vampires out there and that something needs to be done about them. And a lot of this was created by disease and fear. And unfortunately, it brings us to one of the saddest stories associated with vampire lore, the story of Mercy L. Brown. And as sad as this is, it really sheds light on how quickly seemingly rational, modern people, again, 1892, can turn and go kind of crazy when confronted with the fear of death or the other.
In 19th century New England, there was an outbreak of tuberculosis through Rhode Island. The Mercy Brown vampire incident occurred in 1892 when 19-year-old Mercy died from the disease. Her parents were well-respected farmers, and there was no reason to suspect that they were anything but a normal family. However, when the tuberculosis epidemic was reaching a fever pitch, locals needed a scapegoat, and the blame fell on the Brown family. Townspeople decided it was necessary to exhume Mercy and her sister Mary, who had also died of tuberculosis 4 years earlier. When Mary's body was dug up, it was determined that she was not a vampire because the body was decomposing as would be expected. But when they dug up Mercy's body, they found her in excellent condition. There was no decay and her body was not in the position it had been buried. They found fresh blood in her heart, which was immediately removed from her chest and burned to ashes on a nearby rock. The remnants of her heart were mixed with water and given to her surviving family members to drink. The current explanation for this occurrence was that Mercy Brown's body was held in a casket above ground in winter, and many scientists were convinced that her body was in excellent condition because of the freezing temperatures. As for the movement of the body, it most likely occurred during transportation, not as a result of post-mortem transformations.
Yeah, this is sad. It's outrageous that this happened in 1892. Like, the dimmer switch was invented in 1892. We were done with the Civil War. We'd been done with the Civil War for, like, a while. But it really does go to show that when we're faced with death as a culture, we can break through taboos extremely quickly. And as much as we think we're modern and scientific, we still have a remarkable capacity within us to give in to fear and start acting out of it. And it's interesting, too, that this happened around the time when death started being shoved out of the city. You used to have graveyards connected to churches, which was at the center of town. But as cultures and towns were modernizing, burial grounds were pushed further and further out of the city. So people saw less and less death. It was more common for a family member to die in a hospital or some sort of care building and not in the family home. When that gets removed from us, death really does turn incredibly unfamiliar and scary, and it freaks people out a bit. So, these October episodes are moving into some pretty scary territory, or as I like to call it, scaratory. But we're getting spooky out there. It's Halloween. Let's close this out and move on from the heavy stuff, the same way we did with our zombie episode, and start talking about how vampires show up in movies and stuff like that.
Woo!
So, Dorian, do you have a favorite vampire movie?
I really like Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. It's real weird.
That's real fun. It's like black and white, right?
No, it's full color, but Gary Oldman is Count Dracula, and Keanu Reeves is in there, and Winona Ryder.
Wait, so Keanu Reeves is not Dracula?
No.
He's kind of like the perfect Dracula, I don't know
why. Well, he was real young, and
it
had to be shortly after Bill and Ted. So he's in no shape to be a dark, pale, brooding vampire. That one's really good and really surreal. I love Lost Boys, and Near Dark is also one of my favorites. I just love that 80s kind of corny, fun, real punk vampires that...
Hell yeah.
They were bad and they drank blood, but they were like partying and...
Also had motorcycles.
Yeah, they were badass.
How do you feel about Blade?
I low-key love the Blade movies because of how corny they are.
They're
super silly. As far as serious movie, my favorite vampire film is probably Let the Right One In. I haven't seen the remake, the American remake. I don't really care about that.
Probably never gonna watch it.
Yeah, but the original Swedish film, I love it so much. That's still one of my favorite movies.
Can you talk about how the vampire is kind of represented in that movie?
Yeah, she's this, appears to be maybe 12-year-old girl, was turned into a vampire at a very young age, but they never really clarify exactly how old she is.
Yeah.
But she's very, just kind of a small, normal, kind of gangly, weird-looking 12-year-old kid. And that movie still has some of the most unsettling scenes I've ever seen. It's almost like a romance or coming-of-age movie.
Yeah.
But it just has these set pieces in it that are really terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, they hear a noise outside of the hospital where someone is staying, and the nurse looks around, and you kind of get like a shot of her with the hospital in the background as she's looking around outside. She doesn't see anything or hear anything, but then all of a sudden you see Ely, the vampire, crawling up the side of the wall inhumanly. There's just so many scenes in there that are memorable, and she has no problem becoming violent and bloodthirsty.
Yeah.
In some parts, but for a lot of the movie, especially in the scenes with Oscar, the main character, she presents herself as very calm and sweet and just a friendly kid.
Yeah, and that's one of the cool things about vampire movies, is that vampire lore is so expansive that you can make a faithful depiction of a vampire with pretty much any qualities you want to ascribe to it. You know, like you have the Let the Right One In vampire, where they're very normal, but it's just the little quirks, you know, where they can't enter a house.
Right.
Or something like that. But then they can, like, scurry up walls.
Right.
And then you have the vampires in, like, 30 Days of Night, where they're just screaming monsters who are just bloodthirsty, you know, and their only weakness is the sun. And it's really unsettling because of that.
Yep.
And then you've got the classic Nosferatu vampire, where he's just kind of like a corpse that is super gaunt and sickly, who comes out of a crypt and has those super long fingers.
Yeah.
Along that really famous like wall creeping scene. You know, just more unsettling because it's almost that uncanny valley thing.
Yeah.
He's not especially overpoweringly strong. He's just enough like a human that you look at that and you go, something's wrong about that. And it's probably the pointed teeth and the fact that he's going to suck all the blood out of my body.
And it's such an old film that is amplified by the black and white, talky nature of the movie, where it is deeply unsettling to watch this super grainy footage of this almost human but not quite human figure.
Yeah. And it's really interesting to see how vampires have kind of evolved in movies over the years, too. Like, as we mentioned earlier, there's that kind of increased sexualization of vampires.
Right.
as being this suave, other, like, dark-haired, mysterious creature. And that kind of comes out of the Bela Lugosi Dracula movie, where he's this handsome, light-skinned, good-looking count, you know? A lot of the vampire attacks in that movie are portrayed in almost like a very sexual way, where he comes up behind a woman and kind of embraces her and like bites her neck. And it's interesting to see the break in original vampire lore, which was very violent, bloody, and gross, to this very like calculated, suave vampire we have now. Yeah. And you see that come up in Twilight too, you know?
Yeah. That might be part of a bigger question of where horror is going. I've been reading some kind of dorky scholarly articles on horror lately. Part of it to prep for our next bonus episode. But it's interesting that you point that out. For one, Bram Stoker's novel is very... It's a very sexy book.
Yeah.
It's a lot of flirting and lovemaking. And
yeah.
It's super creepy. So
that's like a... There's like the romance triangle.
Yeah.
Love... Well, I guess it's like a love square because it's... She's... That woman's got, like, three different dudes who are trying to date her.
It's kind of a mess.
Yeah.
And the Francis Ford Coppola movie does a good job of maintaining that weirdness
on
the, you know, love quadrangle or whatever. The love rhombus. But one thing that we definitely have a lot of sexiness in horror movies today. Not across the board. Not always. But that's definitely a thing, like,
Slasher movies. Follows was like that too.
Yeah, It Follows in any slasher movie that involves teenagers. You know, I know Linda Williams in particular makes a big deal about how horror is a body genre along with melodramatic movies and pornographic movies. And she makes a big deal about how there's so many horror movies, especially in the slasher genre, where two characters are about to have sex and that's exactly when the slasher strikes. So It's something that is probably worth looking into beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about in this podcast, but horror and sex and the relationship with sex and violence is a weird thing that it seems like we keep making stories to try and poke at it and understand those things and the connection between them.
Yeah.
So it's funny because it's, to some extent, it's definitely like modern audiences. We want to go to movies and we want to see some romance and some sexy bits, but there's other parts of it that I bet there are bigger questions to ask of why we're creeped out by vampires, not just that suck blood, but why they want to like flirt with us and get real close and hug on us before they kill us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting, and it's interesting to see that vampires are kind of the only monster that's gotten swept up in this,
right?
You know,
yeah, they tried the whole sexy zombie thing with one movie, but I don't think that really stuck.
No. That's all I had on vampires today. So
sweet. This is awesome. I love I hate vampires because they so creep me out.
They freak you out real bad.
But it's cool. Like, it's interesting to see how many different iterations. You have really creepy vampires in some movies and books and games, and then you have really dorky ones like in Twilight. It's cool to kind of trace the roots back to all of these different legends and see where they came from a little bit.
Yeah, it's that fascination with death that we've had as humanity our entire existence.
Yeah.
It's cool stuff.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Great work on the research, Max. Thank you very much for presenting that. And thanks for listening. Hey, tell us what you thought. What you think of vampires. What's your favorite vampire? You like the sexy vampires or you like the creepy, gaunt Nosferatu vampires?
I do not like those fingers.
Or do you think that the Nosferatu vampires are sexy and you want to kiss them? Let us know. Tell us all your weird vampire fantasies.
Leech mouth.
We're on social media at PreDeadBoys. You can email us, predeadboys@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do that in a couple ways. You can tip us $3 or more at ko-fi.com/predeadboys. Help us pay our hosting fees and all that good stuff. You can also leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Max, we got a really, really great review.
Great.
This is one of my favorite ones so far. It is titled Death Posse Bros. 5 stars.
Hell yeah.
By Cernium Varium. Sorry if I mispronounced that. They say, I heard about the podcast on the Death Positive Reddit page and started listening immediately. It's my new fave podcast. Definitely recommend to listeners of My Favorite Murder and viewers of the Ask a Mortician YouTube channel. The pre-dead boys have great taste in music, movies, and art, and bring a very endearing sense of humor to their exploration of death and decomposition. Honestly, they're basically the McElroys of death positivity podcasting.
What? Yes!
What?
My head got so big after reading this, it was great. They say, the show also benefits from Max's impressive research. Good job, man.
Thank you.
The episode on spontaneous human combustion was totally fascinating, and I had never heard of the resistance movement led by black New Yorkers in the 1800s that ultimately led to anti-corpse theft legislation.
Yeah.
If you haven't heard that episode, you should definitely go back and listen to it. That was really good stuff. Thanks for the stellar death-positive content, boys. Keep it up. Gonna be recommending this show to lots of folks in Oklahoma.
Cool. I've never been.
It is still buck wild to both of us that there's people not in our hometown that listen to this and want to share it with people. Yeah. So thank you so much, Sirnium Varium. Yeah, that's awesome. We really appreciate your support.
Yeah, I'd get out to Oklahoma, do a live show out there.
What's in Oklahoma? Tell us cool stuff in Oklahoma. I don't know anything about Oklahoma.
Twister.
Yeah, the Suck Zone is in Oklahoma.
The Suck Zone?
You remember that line in Twister?
Yes! Fuck, I forgot about Twister. I forgot about how good that movie is.
Dude, rest in peace, Philip Seymour Hoffman. That was excellent. Our intro and outro music is the song About Time by the band Brat Curse. Check them out at bratcurse.bandcamp.com. And that'll do it for us. Thank you so much for listening. Max, do you have a favorite vampire movie?
I think mine is either Blade 2, specifically, or Let the Right One In.
Yeah, that's excellent. I just remembered a really good one. Have you seen What We Do in the Shadows?
Oh, wait, no.
I forgot about that until just now, and that might be my favorite vampire.
It's like movie. The Office, but with vampires, right?
Yeah, it's from the guys who did Flight of the Conchords, or at least one of the guys. It's these New Zealand comedians. It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's so good. I love, too, that they have different iterations of common vampires, and they also have the Nosferatu dude that's basically their old crotchety roommate who doesn't talk.
Have you seen the movie Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter?
No.
So good.
Is it?
Yeah, it's great. It's really corny.
Okay.
Like, it's a B-movie schlock, but it's really good.
Okay. I'm surprised to hear you say that, but I'll investigate.
Yeah, check it out.
All right. Well, we've got some vampire movies to catch up on. We're going to get out of here. Max and Dorian here reminding you, you're going to rock. Tell that boy to shut the hell up.
Bobby.
God damn it, Bobby.
God damn it. Well, he didn't say that.
Can't say that on TV.
I think he said god damn it.
No, just damn it.
Did he?
You can't say god damn it. That's why they had to bleep god damn out in Panic at the Disco song.
I don't know. I feel like I'm going to find...
people ever heard of...
Well, yeah.
Closing the damn door.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, I know that song. I think the standards were different for Mike Judge than they were for Brendan Urie.
Mike Judge could do whatever he wanted.
I don't know. I'm going to look up a clip and see if I can find a goddamn.
Goddamn, Bobby.
Bobby, you fuckboy.
Total fuckboy, Bobby.
Bobby, you finna snatch my wig.
Mike Judge just created Vine humor.
Bobby, stay out of the peepus room.
Bobby, avocado. Avocado, Bobby.
What's wrong with your son?
That boy needs some milk.
Fuck, I love King of the Hill, man. It's so good.